Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias, let's hoop it up.
You actually combined both of them. You actually did it. I don't know if I'm impressed or disturbed.
How many times I tell you I'm a man of my word? That's all I have.
I appreciate it, but also, is that what we want?
It's what the people ask for.
Okay, well, I guess when you put it out, we got to serve the people. Anyway, playoff basketball still very much in tow. Two games are in for each series at this point. We're going to have a weekend of hoops, so we're going to get some game threes and game fours as well. But let's dig into these game twos and then kind of look ahead to what we're going to be looking for in these series. We will start with the Philadelphia 76ers and the Brooklyn Nets. The Sixers with a game two win over the Nets, 96-84. 20-19-7 for Joel Embiid, though he did have 8 turnovers, functionally 6 because 2 came with like 20 seconds left. Didn't really matter. But anyway, Steve, I was a bit surprised, but also impressed by what Philadelphia did defensively in this one. Because we came into game one asking, hey, how would Brooklyn bend Philadelphia? Could they get Philadelphia to that point? Could they get Philadelphia out of their base? Philadelphia did go out of their base a little bit. Went from the drop, had Embiid at the level. We saw some zone from them, which was interesting. Mikal Bridges saw some 2 to the ball, which was also interesting. Now, how Brooklyn dealt with all of those things, that's a different story. But Philadelphia mixing it up, showing that they could do so, and kind of still doing so on their own terms was pretty interesting to me. I guess that's kind of the big thing that stood out to me with this one. What popped for you in this game, too?
Well, I mean, looking at this series, because, you know, as you like to state, we are recording on a Thursday afternoon, so that game will be complete by the time you hear this, more than likely. I think the fact that, A, they're able to execute multiple coverages is really big for the Sixers, just from a playoff-wide perspective. And then I think that specifically in this series, the question has been, can the Nets score enough? And if we're talking about, you know, Philadelphia taking what Mikal Bridges did in game one and Joel Embiid coming right to the level to start game two. And now we're going to drop and we're showing help from the wing defender on the strong side. You know, you mentioned the switching. You know, if Embiid's on the floor, we're switching. If Embiid's back on the floor and you want to go super small, we're switching 1 through 4. We're throwing the zone at you. That makes it a lot tougher for a Nets team that you had questions and marks about offensively to find the right rhythm. Because the question in every game so far has been, can the Nets open things up? Can they find a way to get to the Sixers defense? And that's where you got to tip your cap to the Sixers for buying in, locking in. If the Sixers are able to continue to throw different things at them, with Bridges playing well, with Cam Johnson playing well, with, I'm assuming, Dinwiddie will have a game at some point in the series, it makes it tougher for Brooklyn to target one thing. And that's like another layer. That's another challenge. So we're thinking, okay, darn, Philly's switching. Brooklyn's looking to maybe put some wings in action. Let's see if they can play out of that. Oh, here's zone. Oh. Well.
We'll try to pass the ball around. Let's see.
Yeah.
And all those zone reps, it felt like they all just ended with Dorian Finney-Smith threes above the break. I was like, well, he can knock down those shots. Also, Philly is more than okay with him taking those shots, which is kind of the point. But continue.
No, I mean, I think that just that puts so much pressure on Brooklyn. It's a lot easier if, hey, if we beat this, we know this is coming. You know, if we beat Joel Embiid in a drop, maybe he comes to the level, we get 2 on the ball, and maybe we get a switch, and now we can play out of that. If they're able to kind of move around like this, you don't know what's happening. And Philadelphia's thrown some double teams at Mikal Bridges, which is hilarious. They've been like, hey, we don't want to do too much, but we also don't want you to do too much. Yeah. So we're going to try and balance that out. And I think that's the big thing, because in this series, that's the Nets formula. Hopefully we can get enough defensively, but without the offense, that defense just doesn't have the same impact. You know, they need to be able to score some baskets to get that done if they want to have a chance to win in the series.
Yeah, and to the Brooklyn scoring point, per Cleaning the Glass, which removes garbage time, a 102.9 offensive rating for the Brooklyn Nets so far through two games. That is the second worst playoff offense. slightly ahead of the New York Knicks at 102.8. And I'm sure we're going to get into the Knicks offense a little bit later in the podcast. But yeah, Brooklyn hasn't been having that much fun. I have a James Harden question for you while we're still on this series.
Do you have a James Harden question, or would you like to make a James Harden statement?
It's more so a question. I don't have a statement yet because the sample is much too small.
Okay.
How have you felt about the aggression from him so far?
I'm still in the same place that I like the way it looks. This feels very eye test adjacent. I understand, but it feels like he's leading the dance more than he had or did last year. Mm-hmm. More than he had in the last couple of years. That's kind of carrying over when it's a Harden and Bean pick and roll. And you see James Harden looking to attack Nick Claxton off the bounce and getting a layup. Okay, that tells me that there's something in there, mm-hmm. as opposed to I'm settling for the step back or I'm settling for that shot. It feels like he's leading the dance is my larger point and where I have a comfort with it. Worst case scenario, you have a bad series. This might be the one to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you at?
I think for me, like, I appreciate that he has attempted to get downhill and mixed in those drives with the step backs. And so from just that perspective, I'm fine with the usage and what he's looked like on that end. I then do zoom in on, okay, what does it look like when he has put his head down? What has it looked like inside the arc? And through two games, if I can do math, we're at 2 of 13 on shots inside the arc for James Harden. And that's where I'm like, one, Brooklyn does pose a very specific issue in that regard. Like, they can switch all over the place. They have versatile defenders. But like, if you're projecting ahead and this team eventually has to go through Milwaukee, or more specifically, they have to go through Boston, it's not like that portion of it is going away for James Harden. Like, you're still going to be facing a team that can throw a lot of different defenders at you and can also offer some size at the rim as well. And so that's why I'm like, he's playing well. I do think the playmaking has really popped for him. Did have some turnovers in that game too, on some weird possessions, particularly in that first half. But overall, like, I've been fine with his process. I do want to see, like, okay, what does the turbo button really look like? Can he get comfortable shots at the rim? And so I'm just keeping an eye on that portion of it.
The tradition continues, folks. The tradition. Duncan asking if James Harden still has the burst.
I would like for him to. Again, I think it's going to be very important. The Sixers are going to need a very high-level version of him to get to where they want to go.
I understand. I think with the step-back mid-range in his back pocket, I feel better with the mindset that I've seen. So, okay. You know, could just be me being me.
That's fair. On the Philly front, a big game for the others as well. Tyrese Maxey exploding for 33 points in this one. Tobias Harris, another efficient outing for him, 20 points. How did you feel about their decision-making? How did you feel about their decisiveness in this one?
I mean, I like the aggression from Philadelphia. I like that they are looking to make plays, make an impact, drive, attack, scrambling defense. I think it, again, ties into the overall game plan where Brooklyn has really, really, really stuck with the doubles. And Philadelphia, for the most part, has really stuck with, we're going to move the ball, we're going to attack, we're going to keep you on your heels, which I think is a big key. Now, if I'm Brooklyn, kind of in a little bit of a pickle here, because the first quarter of game two, or even if you want to widen it out to the playoff series, you've got to bother Joel Embiid, and you've got to hope that Philadelphia either A, gets in their own way, or B, doesn't make shots. The tricky part is that, like, this is going to be tough, because you mentioned the play of those two. Joel Embiid has been so good against these double teams in the series, and the Nets have been so committed, Nikias, that in that game too, they doubled Joel Embiid on a play where he was just trying to dribble handoff to DeAnthony Melton. So to me, I guess widening it out, the Nets now have to wonder, how do we get this done? So they tried some little wrinkles. You've mentioned that they've been doubling from the wing, which has been huge, but it felt like they threw in some strong side corner doubles, trying to catch him off guard from the backside. I do wonder if they try to throw his rhythm off and double once he starts his move, maybe that's their adjustment to try and open this things up or widen it out for them series wise. The tough part is not just the play of the others from the Sixers, but again, to the point that Jackson Frank brought up on this podcast, because the Sixers are so stationary with their spacing, Joel Embiid is able to pick apart and throw those passes on time and on target. And I just don't know how you change your base, because I don't think Brooklyn can afford to let Joel Embiid get loose in this series.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were a couple plays in game two where they let him catch at the elbow and they decided to show help and he went just full Marshawn Lynch to the rim. And so do you,
to freedom.
Yeah, if you let him loose, now you have to go back to the doubles, which Philadelphia has already been hitting, and it gets tricky.
Yeah. And this is kind of where I feel from Brooklyn, because you zoom out on what the game plan has been against Embiid, what it's been against Harden, and what it's been against that two-man action. Like, it's been pretty sound. And even in this game, too, like, the turnovers perked up for both Embiid and Harden in this game. Again, you can remove two from Harden, from Embiid if you want to. That was 30 seconds left. He's just trying to dribble it out, and the Nets are trying to get the ball back. They're already down double figure, so whatever. But, like, they bothered them a little bit. And you zoom out from that game one where the Sixers literally had a historic three-point shooting performance, particularly in the first half. The Sixers shot 31% from three in game two. You held this Sixers offense, which has been elite since December, to 96 points. And you still don't get that one. It just hurts. And it kind of swings me back to the Brooklyn offense and kind of the general theme here. Like, okay, how can they score enough? Like, one thing I brought up after the game one pause, like, hey, can they just math this out a little bit? Can they get more threes up? I think it was 29 three-point attempts in game one. They got up 42 in game two. I don't know if it did enough to really bend Philly in that way. Like, big shout out to Cam Johnson, who just looked a lot more aggressive in that game too. Got threes up, a lot of self-creation there. As who else would you be looking to step up in that regard? Not even just three-point shooting, just in terms of general aggression.
Dinwiddie. He's got to be the guy that is able to break some defenses down, make some pull-ups in, get some scoring. I mean, for me, it's just the story is, can Brooklyn get enough scoring to make what they're doing defensively work? And for Philadelphia, can they keep executing? Can they keep moving the ball? Can they keep this defense up? Once you get to this point in the series, once it flips, this is where it gets fun. You can't let up. Yes, you found a formula to win, but you can't get away from it.
Got you. Before moving on to the next series, just want to throw a quick hat tilt to Paul Reed and the work that he's done off the bench for the Sixers group. Energy's been there. The switching has been pretty solid for him. So just a quick one. Just want to sprinkle it in. Anyway, let's move out west. The Sacramento Kings now up 2-0 on the Golden State Warriors, a 114-106 victory in that game two. There were apparently some antics in game two that led to an ejection and a little bit later a suspension. Do you have any quick thoughts on the Draymond Green suspension before we dig into the actual basketball? Because that's really what I'm care about here.
No.
Okay. Well, then, unfortunate. Draymond's very good, very important. The Warriors are going to have a time trying to adjust without him on both ends of the floor.
Yes, they are. And I'm sorry. You cannot go full Rhea Ripley into Seth Rollins into 1998 Ken Shamrock on the basketball court. Sorry. Continue.
Local angle did it for you, huh?
Yeah.
All right. That's going to then the LA. That's tremendous content. Anyway. For Sacramento, first, I just want to say, Steve, you nailed it during the regular season and during the preview series, the preview episode, where I was like, hey, I picked the Warriors in six, and I mean, technically, they can still do that. I picked Warriors in six. I was like, going through whatever you can glean from the regular season series between those two and just what the Kings have been defensively this year, I have concerns about them defending this Warriors team. And the point that you made was, hey, I wonder if you get them in a playoff series, they're able to focus in on one thing or just one team. Can they do enough there? And to this point, not only have the Kings been better defensively, like statistically, and again, you can't extrapolate a 2-game sample to like an 82 game sample, it's irresponsible, but they've defended at an elite level through 2 games. So hat tip to you for that. And that's kind of where I want to start with this Kings team. particularly in game two, they have been working defensively. They haven't nailed 100% of things. No team does. But the Warriors trying to get into their post split action. They are switching. They are being physical. There's been some chatter about the physicality. I don't really want to get into that either. But they have been physical on the off-ball actions. They have been switching pretty well. If there are help points on the floor for Golden State, whether that's Draymond, if it's Kevon Looney on the perimeter, if they have Gary Payton II in, if they have Jonathan Kuminga in, they are helping off of that guy. The rotations behind that have mostly been crisp. I've just been very impressed with what the Kings have done defensively. And all they had to do was get the defense to a level. And again, this is a level higher than I anticipated. But all they needed was to get the defense to a level so they can force misses or force turnovers. And then they can run and get out in transition. And they have been beating the Warriors over the head in transition through two games of the series.
Just to add your defense point, this is a Sacramento team that, despite their flaws, despite the noise, they give the effort that you mentioned. They're going to try hard. It may not always work, but the effort's always going to be there. And I think in this particular series, this is a Golden State team that does not present some of the challenges that could really, really hurt them. The dribble penetration from Golden State hasn't been there. So the drives outside of the sets isn't hurting them in the same way. And pick and roll is a concern, but how many people is it a concern with? And that's where it's like, okay, the Kings have one team they can focus on. It's movement-based, kind of like them. They can lock in on one person. They can fly around. They give themselves an opportunity. And with the tempo and the pace, you have a little bit of a more of a margin for error than a team that's just kind of clubbing you over and over again. But it does tie me to my one point before you can
say,
they are going to have to deal with Stephen Curry and that high pick and roll. It's not going away. And that feels like the one. So obviously this is another game that's going to be played and you'll be listening to it after the game. But Stephen Curry in high pick and roll, that high screen, Stephen Curry leading the dance, two on the ball. That is going to be the fun battle to see how it lands throughout the series. The Kings, to your point about their defense, they do feel comfortable with their help in that spot. They do feel comfortable if it's Kevon Looney having to roll that far and we can kind of stunt or get back and recover. Can the Warriors make them pay? Can they use their movement and their shooters to now get two on the ball and open up rolls that way? Can they poke at the Kings defense that eventually, because of the shooting ability, is going to put two on the ball somewhere?
Yeah. And I'm glad you hit on that, because that just unlocked some clips that I had in my head where the Warriors were able to generate some good stuff, whether it's a post split or going into a pick and roll and flowing into something else. If they go side to side and then they end up involving like Sabonis there and it's an empty corner, they've been able to get some good stuff out of that with a big slipping and then kind of setting up some of those high lows. And I think just zooming out, like one, Kevon Looney was already going to be very important in this series. And that's why I had him as my X factor. I'm like, I know what Draymond can do on the short roll. I don't think Kevon Looney is a bad short roll player. Can he hit enough of the notes? And now with Draymond Green going to be out for this game three, it becomes even more important. What does Kevon Looney as a screener look like? I am intrigued by that one. Because even with the Kings in some of those situations with Kevon Looney, they're kind of sitting on, hey, we're not giving up the lob if you're throwing the ball into Kevon Looney on the short roll. Like, he's going to have to make a kick somewhere or he's going to have to score on the short roll. And it was a little bit better in game one than it was in game two for Kevon Looney. You also have to just keep an eye on his foul trouble in general, because he is very important to what the Warriors have needed defensively. He's taken on a lot of the Sabonis matchup. And on that note, Sabonis did score rather efficiently in game two, bounce back from the game one. But I guess this just leads me into some Warrior questions. Like, where do they go lineup wise now? Because you mentioned like the drivers, and I think that's a big part. And that goes into like some Jordan Poole talk that we could have if we want. But beyond that, do we see Jamichael Green getting some minutes at the five now? Do you just go to Kuminga, you'll be our backup five now? And can we unlock some stuff with you as a roller?
Well, I anticipate Kuminga sliding into some of that role. I don't know if they go Jamichael, but that would make sense. I think Gary Payton, the second is going to be huge for the Warriors. How they get there, I'm interested. But if you're asking me who's a roller, it's probably Kuminga and GP2 that stand out to me. And it kind of ties into series wide. Do the Warriors have the lineups they want in this matchup? Do they feel comfortable going two-way with the smalls? Do they feel comfortable being able to keep the ball in front? Because we talk about the Kings defense. The Warriors defense in the series has had trouble with dribble penetration. And that's not necessarily like the Kings thing. It's like a bonus.
Yeah. Yeah, a sub-bonus. I get it. That, there it is. We've been doing this podcast way too long. But no, on that point, a quick shout out to ESPN's Kendra Andrews, wrote an article on how the Kings have scored efficiently against this Warriors group. And she had a note in there that the Kings are producing 1.15 points per possession in the half court. And that's the highest allowed by a team against Steve Kerr in the playoffs throughout his entire era, which, again, it's two games. This can change by the time you listen to this, since the game three is a little bit later. But that's the level that the Kings have been at. And this is with, you know, Malik Monk didn't set the world on fire like he did in game one. Domantas Sabonis didn't have a great offensive game one. And they've still been able to score rather efficiently against this group. So actually, on the rotation front, are you surprised by the minute distribution with Dante DiVincenzo? I think it was like 12 minutes in game two. Like, I guess I'm just surprised that he hasn't played more. Like, I would imagine, like, Andrew Wiggins getting more minutes was obviously going to dip into that. But I didn't expect it to end up being basically like two stints for him. And this is kind of it. Like, it hadn't felt like he's played poorly.
I would say keep an eye on the minutes in game three and then circle back with me. Okay. Because I think it's a product of other folks. And then it would be how many minutes do Gary Payton and Dante DiVincenzo play together?
Okay.
Because if Steph's going to play 40, Wiggins is going to play 40, Clay's going to play 40, there's only so many to go. Unless you're going to go super small.
Okay. Makes sense. And shoot, they may have to in this game without Draymond. So we'll see how that goes. I guess my larger thematic question I have, how do you think the Warriors are dealing with this pace from the Kings? Both in the half court and just in transition. Like I've mentioned, the transition defense hasn't been great. But how have you felt about the pace of play and how Golden State's dealt with that?
Well, I think the Kings, it's more not just the total pace. I mean, the Warriors like to play fast, but just the tempo that the Kings play with. The way that they flow from transition right into their actions. And Golden State has fought. They've battled. I think they've done a great job being active against handoffs. I think they've done a really good job of trying to rotate and take things away. It just wears on you. And that's where I think you're seeing the drives open up. And you're seeing them having to defend multiple actions every single time. I think it's just kind of, they're taking body blow after body blow. And they can't necessarily get the Kings towards the mud, if that makes sense.
Got you. Apparently not the only party to receive a body blow. Now, to the Cavs and the New York Knicks. The Cavs were able to notch this series up 1-1 with a 107-90 victory over the Knicks. That wasn't really that close. Huge bounce back game from Darius Garland. Big game from Donovan Mitchell as well. Didn't show so much in terms of scoring, but 13 assists in that one. 24 points off the bench for Caris LeVert in that game. I'm intrigued by Cleveland's rotation, period. Like, one, the secondary pieces are just going to matter. And I think the big game from Caris LeVert showcased that. Only 2 minutes for Isaac Okoro in this game. And I imagine at least some of that is just Caris has it rolling. And if he can hold up defensively and he gives you the scoring and playmaking blend, like, you're going to roll with him naturally. I do wonder, like, is that kind of the way that Cleveland attempts to open things up offensively for them?
I think it is. And unfortunately for Isaac Okoro, this is a series where the Knicks showcase so much defensively in game one that was built on helping off of a big and helping off of him that it made it difficult to find the openings with how committed the Knicks were. And so I think Caris LeVert, obviously very important, very big. His play matters, but that small lineup is huge for Cleveland. You know, now if it's Jalen Brunson on LeVert, he's got to be way more engaged. If they're small, whether it's Mobley or Allen at the five, you have one of the Knicks' bigs working to contain and pick and roll. A, the help is smaller from the Knicks, and you're usually helping off of a shooter. So let's say, for example, when Cleveland goes empty corner pick and roll when they're small, the Knicks had done a really good job, especially when Okoro was in, of, hey, I'm helping, I'm playing two, we're fine with this pass. Yep. That becomes a lot different when the two people are Darius Garland and Caris LeVert. And it gets trickier if they decide to let LeVert initiate some actions. They could dip into that if they wanted to. But now that help is helping off of them. Garland's able to get an extra pass, or he's able to get a drive. It just hurts some of the automatic help that the Knicks had. As so, to my point, I think going with Caris, he's going to be key in the series. And then Danny Green, at the very least, is going to have the reputation to where we don't feel great about it. Say what you want about players, but reputation shooting, it carries with you.
That it does. That it does. And Alex, just to bounce off of an earlier comment that you made there, touching on Darius Garland off the ball, like, what did you like about his usage? Because that was something that popped for me. It was a lot of him being spaced one pass away, him on the weak side. This felt like the Cleveland Cavaliers were pretty intentional about moving him around the chessboard a little bit more in light of how the Knicks defended him in game one.
Yeah, I think that's a big key, is finding ways, whether it's Mitchell on the ball or Garland on the ball, using the other one as a pressure point and having them help make the defense pay. So to your point, moving those guys around was huge. And I think it's a lot easier to do that with the small lineup than with the big lineup. And the reason I say that is because with that big lineup, the Cavs still have to find their rhythm and their spacing. Because Jared Allen, he can start in the short corner. He can start in the dunker spot. Mitchell Robinson is stepping up and saying, hey, look, I'm here. And yeah, y'all put two on the ball, but I'm here to help. And one of you bigs got to finish over me. So that doesn't necessarily change as much. And we've seen Cleveland try to kind of move the pieces around with the big lineup. Mm-hmm. If they can nail that big lineup with what the small lineup has found, with the matchup hunting they can throw in, with the pull-ups from Donovan Mitchell, the offense changes.
Got you. Let's flip sides very quickly. Again, Darius Garland got free. Donovan Mitchell had himself a good game. Jalen Brunson, a little quieter on the impact front. What did you see from Cleveland defensively?
I think the Cleveland Cavaliers defense did a really good job of working to keep Jalen Brunson out of rhythm. I thought the biggest thing that they did was they went to traps, two on the ball. Hey, we're going to put two on the ball, and you're going to have to play out of it. Now, for me, I'm very interested to see what the adjustment from the Knicks is. It's very interesting to see Mitchell Robinson setting a high pick and roll, and he's catching the ball at the free throw line, and like, hey, man, wait.
Buddy. Yeah, I want to be kind, but yeah, the Mitchell Robinson short roll reps was like, that's kind of tough.
But this is the tricky part. Because now, if Cleveland's going to automatically do that, the Knicks should have time to adjust and move some of the pieces around. So maybe Jalen Brunson gets a lower screen, an empty corner up your side, those kind of things. I thought the other thing they did against Brunson, great early help. Multiple possessions in that game where, hey, we're going to be active on ball, but you're going to look, if you're on this right side of the floor trying to go one-on-one, there's going to be someone at the nail, there's going to be someone on the baseline. We're going to try and just keep you out of rhythm. Take some options away. That was big for me.
Okay. I was just very, once I saw Cleveland start trapping, my mind immediately went to the Heat-Knicks game that I was at earlier in the regular season. Where the Heat, like, actually, no. After that first quarter where he started lighting up Kevin Love, it was like, actually, no. We're not going to let you do that. We're just going to double, and we're going to make these other guys make not only good decisions, but make quick decisions. And the Knicks mostly did enough in that game to end up winning it. And I was like, I wonder if a team is going to try to test this out. And to Jalen Brunson's credit, again, he got the traps. It wasn't like he was overwhelmed and had six turnovers or anything like that. He handled them well. But once the ball swung, it was like, okay, how quickly are you going to move it? How quickly are you going to drive? Are you going to knock down the shots that are afforded here? And we're in small sample zone now. Like, it's the playoffs. It doesn't matter what your rep is. If you don't nail it, that's all Cleveland needs. And it's not like this is a Knicks team that plays with a ton of pace anyway. And so if they get you further in the mud and they're able to cut off the head of the snake here in Jalen Brunson, it does get a little bit interesting. And this is when you zoom back out with this Knicks offense. Like, hey, this hasn't been a great three-point shooting team all year long. Like, they've won, again, with efficient play inside the arc, extra possessions with offensive rebounds, and not turning the ball over. And if you're not able to get the efficient stuff inside the arc, because now you have, again, you mentioned the Mitchell Robinson rep with him in the short role. Like, if he's now dictating things instead of Julius Randle, and the Cavs are able to stay at home at all because of the size they have on the back end, where do the Knicks go from him? Go from here? And so I guess heading into the game three, like, what adjustments? You mentioned some, maybe some lower picks in the corner. Anything else you can see them to try to loosen the shackles of their offense? Because, again, you noted after game one, they won it, but the offense wasn't great there either.
Well, I'm interested to see if the Cavs stick with that against Jalen Brunson and if that opens things up for the Knicks, because they haven't really been able to open things up in that sense. Overall, I think the Knicks just need to make quicker decisions. The ball has to move quicker. They have to try and get to drive and kick. How many times have they really beat Garland and Mitchell off the bounce?
Hasn't felt like a ton.
And so that's
not to get all the way to the rim either, at least. Yeah.
Cleveland delivers a tough equation of those two bigs, but if you can't even get in the paint, it makes it difficult. They've got to be able to get to drive and kick. It just has felt like all of their scores are just going to exhaust their option and then move it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is no disrespect to RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley. Obviously, they have to play better, but I don't know if you need screen, stop, rescreen, stop.
Yeah.
Like, where's Harden signs going to play as many minutes? Where is handoffs at? Is he improving with the movement? What kind of pressure are you really putting on Cleveland outside of we got stops, transition? Here's Jalen Brunson. Here's some Julius Randle, and the rim's up there somewhere.
Yeah, you can't do that. I'm glad you touched on the what I literally had in my notes was like, hey, where have the non-Brunson guards been through two games of this one? It's been really quiet for Emmanuel Quickley. It's also been quiet for RJ Barrett in terms of the, you know, screen, stop, hold, stuff like that. Like, that's unfortunately part of the RJ experience right now. Like, the processing speed just kind of waxes and wanes. Decisiveness kind of waxes and wanes. To see Quickley look a little indecisive has been a little bit of a surprise to me. And they need him to provide more. Ah, I see. Yes, he is coming off the bench.
Oh.
Ah, I see. I'm not following you up on that. But anyway, they need better from him. Gonna need better from RJ Barrett as well. And with that, we can move to the Clippers and the... Oh, go ahead.
I had one more thing before we move.
Okay.
If you want to talk about things the Knicks have to do, Julius Randle against the small lineup has to change. That has to be something they could use. You either got to get Brunson with two on the ball against the small lineup, or you got to get some touches for Julius Randle at the small lineup. Elbow, post, that's the time. I don't know if, like, the elbow touches against Evan Mobley and then spacing against Danny Green is the best formula, but they got to find a way to get him in rhythm and try and make Cleveland pay and make that small lineup a little less tenable.
Got you. And for clarity's sake, is this more so the Knicks have to use him better against those small lines, or is there something that you want him to do better?
I would like them to use him better.
Okay.
Open up the playbook if you have Randle in against the small lineup. Use that as your time to reestablish some of the things you did during the season.
Okay. Makes sense. All right, let's move. The Suns notching up the series, a 115-110 victory over the Los Angeles Clippers, 38 from Devin Booker, 25 from Kevin Durant, 14 and 13 for DeAndre Ayton. Another 17 points for Torrey Craig. Chris Paul reaching double digits in this one. 16 points, 8 dimes. Many of mid-range jumpers, particularly late. Nice to see. My eyes kind of glossed to the reps against drop. Really just the reps against the Clippers centers in general, but especially against drop. It felt like they got a little bit more juice out of that. I will say, and kind of zoom out, this is part of the shot profile issue that I had with the Suns, and this is not a new thing. They were able to win this game. They are absolutely living in the mid-range area, even against the drop. It's such a high threshold for them to hit, but then you look at what they did in that second half and in that fourth quarter, you also realize very quickly, oh, they can actually hit this. Devin Booker, wild. Kevin Durant, wild. Chris Paul, again, exciting fourth quarter for him. just snaking and getting those pull-up jumpers. It's a tough mark to hit, but when they hit it, it's incredibly difficult to deal with. But I think they really dinged Zubac and Mason Plumlee in a way that they just weren't able to in game one, and that kind of swung things.
It's such, that's the fun mini battle of it. So obviously we'll have more results of this one going forward. But if you're looking at the bigger spectrum of this series, this is a Clipper team that has a win on the road, has their formula. They have their defense. They have their belief. They have Kawhi. They can flip matchups. They can shell help. They can mix their coverages. And you felt it as far as just the Suns just never really finding a rhythm.
Yeah.
Spurts were there, but they never felt like they had like that flow, that consistent rhythm, that one thing that Phoenix has. And that's the unique challenge that the Clippers present. That I don't know if too many other teams in their bracket is going to deliver to them. But the one thing about Phoenix, as you mentioned, once they find that one thing, they keep going. And bigs, come here. Come here. We're you want to be in a drop? We're going to just explore the space, get to that pull-up. Now, what intrigued me was, A, they made those because that's the look at the personnel they have. B, yep. What was the reaction? When DeAndre Ayton was able to kind of get a couple jumpers, I was like, By the end of the game, when DeAndre Ayton was able to get a roll and a finish, I was like, oh. And this is why. The Clippers have been hesitant to put two on the ball, and I think it's less because of the personnel and more because of what that hands Phoenix. Because that opens up a whole other portal of the playbook. If we can just get two on the ball. Hey, sweet trap there. That's Kevin Durant over there.
Yeah, you have fun tagging from over there, bud.
that's Torrey Craig rolling, but still, have fun. If the Suns keep hitting those and that's the poison they decide to deliver, it gets tricky because, again, big picture wise, can the Clippers play big? And then you combine that with, can the Clippers play small? Now, keep in mind, big-wise, they tried drop. They tried to scram Zubac out of the pick and roll, which was hilarious because it opened up things for Kevin Durant. They tried switch. They were funneling through things in the fourth, and I was like, interesting. They went small. You got to remember, Clippers lineups, a little smaller than usual.
Yeah, that's the big one.
Phoenix decided, oh, and they raised their hand. This is something that will happen probably in the future. Kevin Durant, come screen. Get this switch. Double and, oh, that's Devin Booker attacking a scrambling defense. If the Clippers have that dual issue, that's where their formula gets tapped. That's where they get hit. That's where it gets tricky. So that's where my intrigue is with this series. Can Phoenix keep hitting those shots at that rate? Do the Clippers keep believing in their multiple coverages and their drop, and can they play their big and small lineups?
I got you. On the Clippers front, you mentioned two to the ball, and that's something that they don't want to do. The Suns have tried to sprinkle that in against Kawhi Leonard. Have you felt about the extra attention that they gave in game two? Do you think that's tenable at all, or does he just pass the ball too well?
Kawhi's passing has been really, really good in this series, and I am intrigued with the volume of the Suns doubling Kawhi. Is that something they decide, hey, we're just going to live with the rotations, maybe as the game goes on? We're going to take these 4 or 5 minutes and not you. I guess, like, and then where do the Clippers respond? Because, you know, are they going to double full from the perimeter? Is it going to be just post-ups? Like, how do they kind of navigate that? So I'm intrigued to see which way each team goes. But you got to give Kawhi a salute.
That man's great.
He has not only made the shots, go-go gadget with the defensive steals, and the passing has been great.
I've just loved watching him. This is what healthy Kawhi looks like, and I'm glad that we're getting to see that on full display. I'm in a weird place with the doubles. One, obviously, Kawhi is good enough to warrant them, and I do think the Suns can execute it. But I also look at what this Clippers offense can be in the half court sometimes, and I'm just like, do you want to feed them 4-on-3s? Because, again, they don't need to be like the 15-16 Warriors. They just need to be good enough for that, to do that 3 more times. Moving forward. And so my mind just goes to, it's hard to say, do you live with Kawhi knocking down contested shots? But like, you go back through the game one film, how many of his buckets were poorly defended? How many of his actions were poorly defended? It didn't feel like a lot of them were. It's just a very small margin for error against Kawhi. And even if it isn't there, he can knock down shots anyway.
Did you remove the Chris Paul Landry Shamet possessions?
No, I didn't. And that's a good call. But I'm saying in general, it's not a lot of Kawhi blows past this dude, a whole defense collapse kick is my major point. They did have to navigate the Chris Paul thing. But like on the possessions where Torrey Craig was able to stick with him, or when you got KD on him and he's able to knock down shots anyway, it's like, okay, some of that is just, this is Kawhi Leonard, he's good. Can you afford to push the meter that way and really ramp up the doubles? Like, how okay are the Suns with that, I guess is my broader question.
No, I mean, it's a good point. Handing a Clipper team that doesn't always get you in rotations may not be the thing you want to do. Because now, A, they're going to let it fly. And B, if that opens up drives as well, you know, what have you accomplished?
So that's mostly my big question there. And again, I'll just give a quick shout out to Torrey Craig, who is fighting his tail off defensively. But offensively, the corner shots that the Clippers have fed him, and boy, they do not care when he is spaced. He's knocked them down. When he's been used as a roller, he's gotten some short roll opportunities. Even off the ball, he's been lifting up to the free throw line and getting some short jumpers there. Like, he is scoring at a rate that they need him to. Like, he's been the... If he knocks him down, we tip our cap. It's been some cap tipping through two games for what Torrey Craig has been able to do. Last question I have for you, like, the Suns did go with a little bit more KD at the five. It feels like the dosage of that is increasing a little bit as we close out the season, now heading to the series. How have you felt about the KD at five lineups?
To be determined. I want to see more.
Okay. Fair enough.
Tough series for me to gauge it on. I've been more impressed with Bismack Biyombo switching.
Bismack been working too. Bismack has been working too. All right. We'll stay out west, or we'll stay, I guess, LA adjacent. The Grizzlies notching up the series. No Ja Morant, no problem. A 103-93 victory. Xavier Tillman with 22-13, 18 for Jaren. Luke Kennard with some positive minutes off the bench. Desmond Bane with 17. I want to start first with, again, impressive win for the Memphis Grizzlies. I really enjoyed the Xavier Tillman minutes on both ends. Like, one timely offensive rebounds, getting busy in transition, a couple of post-ups, just bodying Jared Vanderbilt a couple of times. Like, okay, this is cool. Also, his work defensively, getting the LeBron assignment, and mostly holding his own, forcing him into some jumpers, not finding himself in foul trouble. I think he really put in work. And I was really impressed with what he was able to do specifically for this Grizzlies team. Like, the box score itself is going to be nice, but there are a lot of little things that he did and some stuff that he was able to blow up. Like, I think there was a possession with Austin Reeves handling LeBron, beats David Roddy on the cut, and he's kind of roaming around the rim. AD is spaced on the left wing. He's able to meet the guy at the rim. It's like, okay, these are the kind of little plays that you need him to make. Very impressed with what Memphis was able to do, the way they were able to get busy in transition. A lot of that was what they did defensively overall. A lot of that was also the Lakers' process offensively. We will dig into what that has been. On the Lakers' front, my eye kind of goes to LeBron and the LeBron usage. Like, I came into the series on this very pod. It was like, hey, which LeBron are we getting? How often will we see the turbo button pressed? Looked it up earlier today. He has logged 9 drives through 2 games. And some of those were the transition clips. I'm just like, I don't know if that's tough to swallow. Especially when you factor in the amount of threes that he's taken and the efficiency hasn't been there through 2 games. And that can obviously flip very quickly, but haven't loved that. But then I kind of looked into, okay, what were the touches in this game too? Way more post-ups for LeBron in game 2 versus game 1. And my mind immediately went to, is this the way they kind of counter taking some of that strain off of LeBron to try to beat this Memphis defense or this set defense? Can we just get him closer to the basket naturally? Again, Dylan Brooks is a strong dude. He's still stronger than Dylan Brooks. Xavier Tillman is a strong dude. He can set up shop against them at the very least. And the Lakers were able to get some good stuff out of those post-ups. Do we see an increase in that? And I guess in general, how have you felt about the usage with him through two games?
I think that for me, it's interesting. I think the post-up and the elbow touches are going to be key for LeBron. The fun part is Memphis decided, hey, LeBron, Anthony Davis, your pick and rolls are going to be a switch. That was intriguing to me because of the drives we haven't seen from LeBron so far. Mm-hmm. And can Anthony Davis make them pay? And you wonder, is he trying to establish Anthony Davis to a degree in this series? Because if AD can do that, then that may open some things up. I think with LeBron, you have him being LeBron, but also the Grizzlies being able to throw lineups out there. I believe game one, it was like Ja, Desmond Bain, Luke Kennard, Tyus Jones were all on the floor. And then in game two, it was Conchar on the floor with Kennard. And it's interesting because the Lakers don't necessarily have the screening partners for LeBron to necessarily make Memphis pay outside of Austin Reeves. Him and Austin Reeves have been very good in pick and roll. So for me, it's less the usage and can they use him as a pressure point earlier? And how important is that? Like, what? I think I tie him more to the overall offensive process. Because in the second half, you saw him involved more with the post-ups, being involved in pick and roll and what that did and open things up. In the first half, they didn't have that hierarchy. It didn't feel like they were trying to hit X, Y, or Z. It just kind of felt like, okay, this might be here, this might be there. So I think for me with the Lakers, it's more important for them to just lock in on what they want to do better than anything else.
Got you. And it would be a little bit easier for them to do that if the guard play was a little bit better, to your point. I'm sure you have more on that. beyond, I guess, before turning it over to you fully, how much of the process do you think is dictated with some of the spacing that they have in some of the lineups that they're playing?
I think it's more what they run. So even with the spacing, the Memphis is going to be an early help team. So even if you're going to go empty corner pick and roll, make a quick decision. Because they're going to help off the nail. They're going to help somewhere. Mm-hmm. Either get a shot or a drive. Just get into it quicker and play out of it. The possessions where it's dribble up, one pick and roll, now we back out, maybe we throw in the post. I don't know who that serves.
That makes sense.
I think you play slower. You allow Memphis to kind of just dictate terms a little bit. I imagine we'll see LeBron get some more pick and roll and let him read what Memphis does. So that way, even if he's not driving left and right, he can, you know, get some skip passes, force some help, put some pressure on the Grizzlies that way.
I got you. I ask because, like, I look at the game two specifically, and I think before I even get into this, like, a lot of this is going to be dictated by how healthy is Ja, how available will he be moving forward in this series. But, like, I kind of had the thought bubble when Ja was announced out. I was like, okay, wait a minute. So what is the Jared Vanderbilt matchup in this game? Who are they going to place him on? Will they put him on Jaren? Will they have him chasing Desmond Bane? Will they continue, you know, with the point guard thing, put him on Tyus Jones, try to blow up some stuff or whatever? And then I kind of flipped the floor and was like, okay, will the defensive impact be enough to kind of override some of the concerns that you have with him offensively? Because Memphis is okay with hiding. Obviously, Jaren's been on him, so he can roam around. They've been fine hiding weaker defenders on him. And he does just kind of restrict space for this Lakers team. And he's not the only player in the rotation that Memphis is okay with helping off of, to be clear. But I do eye those men as like, is there room to dip those a little bit in light of what the offense has been through two games for the Lakers?
I don't like it because eventually Ja's going to come back at some point.
Yeah.
So I think Jared Vanderbilt's too important to them defensively. I think I get the concept of having more spacing, but is this someone that Memphis is actually going to guard? Are they going to make enough shots to make you pay? Are they going to mess up your defensive infrastructure? I think you need Vanderbilt for some of the slashing, some of the cutting, some of the rebounding, just some of the effort. I think that's a trade-off you got to make. Okay. I can understand maybe going a little bit longer with maybe a Troy Brown or a Beasley, depending on the night, but it's tough when you are also playing your small lineup as well. Mm-hmm. So eventually Vanderbilt's got to play with somebody.
Yeah.
And if LeBron's going to be in your small lineup, you don't want to do LeBron and Vanderbilt out there. Although technically you could use Vanderbilt as a screener, but I kind of get the concept.
I got you. Just wanted to test the waters on that. Quick stat again, small sample. We only got two games. The Lakers with a 121.6 offensive rating in the 51 minutes that Jared Vanderbilt has not been on the floor in this series, a 105.4 with him on in 45 minutes. And with him, AD, and LeBron on, it's around a 98 offensive rating. It has not been very good. Again, that's not all on him, but in terms of who he got game one matchup wise and some of the usage, I think he is set under 10 on ball picks so far through two games. So the Lakers haven't used him a ton as a screener yet. That can obviously flip moving forward. That's where my wheels just kind of got churning on that front.
Nah, I hear you. I mean, for me, it's they have the stars, but both teams are kind of, you're starting to understand what they can't afford to have happen. The Lakers need the drives. They need to get the drive and kick. They need good offensive process. They need their defense to be good. Grizzlies, Ja or not, they need the ball movement. They need everyone involved, which I think is a big plus of what happened in game two. And if Ja stays out, you have to guard all these guys. And they're going to have some point guardless lineups where the ball is moving, which is what they need anyways. You have to deal with Jaren Jackson Jr., you know, attacking your small lineup. So how can each team flip it? It's going to be fun. The winner of this series is going to win it. Great analysis, I know, but they don't have to take it.
No, you're 100% right. And to the point guardless lineup point that you made, perfect opportunity for me to give the quick hat tip to Luke Kennard, who has played well on both ends. The Lakers have tried to hunt him. It hasn't always gone well. Some of that is just the Lakers' process on that front. We will leave that alone. But he's held up. The shooting has been important. The playmaking has been important. The Grizzlies are plus 17 in his 50 minutes so far through two games. I had questions, you know, when we did the trade deadline show. Like, I like Luke. I think he's good. Will he shoot enough? You know, will you have any kind of volume questions in Memphis? And ultimately, can he play? You know, can he play in the playoffs defensively? Can he hold up enough? Won't be an effort ordeal, but will he be hunted? And will Memphis be able to compensate for that? Through two games, he's been able to hold up. He's been a very valuable piece for them. And you really saw that value shine through in the game, too, without Ja Morant. They needed the extra handling and the shooting, and he was there. Go ahead.
Can I be respectfully messy for 2 seconds?
Yes.
Do you think Dylan Brooks's post-game comments put a bullseye on all the non-Dylan Brooks defenders?
You know, that would be the funniest answer to that, right? It's like, I don't respect anyone unless they put 40 on me. LeBron's like, oh, okay. Hey, bud, can you come screen here? Let's get Dylan Brooks over here, right? I want to draw 40 on you. And now you go back in that locker room. Let's see what those post-game comments are going to be. Oh, my goodness. But no, that's going to be a fun series. And obviously, hovering over all this, I hope Ja's able to get back in the series. I hope he's doing all right. Hope the hand heals. Go ahead.
Can I be respectfully messy again for a second?
Yes, you can.
I respect Dylan Brooks and him being himself and the mindset that he carries from a night-in, night-out basis. Saying you don't respect someone unless they drop 40 on you about the all-time NBA leading score is absolutely hilarious.
That man does not care. He said, and he literally started his answer with, I don't care, he old. Like, oh. Well, I'm not sure what you do with that. Actually, one last Laker question before we move here. Anthony Davis, quiet night, 13 points, didn't shoot very well from the field. Did you feel like that was, did you have an issue with his usage? Did you just feel like, hey, he just didn't have the shots going? Like, for me, watching that live, then going back through some of the clips earlier today, it felt like he got some pretty solid shots he just didn't make. It didn't feel like he's getting pushed around, weird effort game or anything like that. It just felt like he missed that. Was that your read, or how did you feel about the way he was used in game two?
I felt like he missed. I think there's some things they could use. Like, I still think there's different ways they could use him because of his talent. But no, I don't think it was necessarily he didn't show up. I thought his defense was pretty good for the majority of the night, which is just as important. So it'll come.
He's been such a world beater defensively this year, man.
I wish people would take what they're saying about AD and give some praise to Rui or talk about the guards.
You want to talk about those Laker guards?
Nope, take it somewhere else, man.
Okay, all right. Well, then, We will go to Milwaukee, who responded, no Giannis in this one. Still waiting to see what his availability would be like in games three and moving forward. But Milwaukee beat Miami 138-122 to notch up the series. A franchise record 25 made threes for the Milwaukee Bucks, which, hey, you're probably going to win some games if you knock down those kind of shots. Miami shot well from three. It wasn't that, though, and it wasn't that volume either. So there you go. Steve, I came into this one. You know, woke up Thursday morning. I was like, you know what? I am ready to be incredulous. Like, huh? Using Brook Lopez against small players? That can work? Wow. And then I watched the game. And yes, you should still use Brook Lopez, because why would you not use Brook Lopez, especially with the height advantage and stuff like that? He's also just good at basketball. You should probably utilize him without Giannis. That's all true. But man, Miami's defense.
Oh.
In that game.
Okay, so this is going to be the smoke series from Nekias.
I don't want it to be the smoke series. But my word. It is one thing. If you just get beat inside with Bobby Portis post up, Brook Lopez post up, because you're just not big enough. All right. That stinks. You don't want to lose a playoff game, especially after you just got game one. This is an opportunity to go up two games with no Giannis, golden opportunity, whatever. That's one thing. The amount of dribble penetration that Miami gave up in this game. Jrue Holiday getting downhill. Grayson Allen getting downhill. Joe Ingles getting downhill and scrambling you and dropping dump off the Bobby Portis lurking around the dunker spot. You're just getting beat. That can't happen. Watching them in transition was a chore this morning when I went through that game. Failure to match up. Watching them switch, which this is what they did in game one, so it shouldn't have been a surprise. Watching them switch in the half court and the amount of times Milwaukee just got two on the ball because the switching was not great. The miscommunication on switches. Like, just virtually every portion of fundamental defense, Miami got a minus next to in that game. And that's in addition to Milwaukee could not miss from three. They had some fun pull-ups in transition, some contested threes. But like a lot of this was just they couldn't contain anything from anywhere, from just about anyone. I just found myself very disappointed with Miami's defense more than anything else. That just can't be the effort. And to Milwaukee's point, I mean, to Milwaukee's credit, again, glad they utilized Brook. Jrue Holiday just, 27 assists through two games now? Like, he's very quietly having a good decision-making series so far. And you know how I'll harp on that. The offense in general just flowed a lot better for Milwaukee. Miami's defense was not great, but concept-wise, it looked like they had more of a purpose. That helps. And this is what the book, maybe not this level because the shooting was historic, but like this is what Milwaukee's offense can look like when they find the pressure points and hit them consistently. So props to them. Also, Miami's defense, good Lord. Rant done. I will concede the floor to you, good sir.
Okay. Very interesting in that we have two games where two teams have lost their mind from three. And we have some kind of fun things. We also have Giannis coming. I'm intrigued. Mm-hmm. I think the ball movement was better for Milwaukee. I think to your point about Miami's defense, it's pretty clear in this series, Miami's best defense is going to be their offense. They are going to have to score enough to get this done. Now, I say that after a game where Miami probably had a really good stretch of offensive process. That Milwaukee just said, hey, cool, we're just going to hit a bunch of threes in this 2 minutes. And now you're down 10. And then we're going to play really hard defensively, and now you're down 20. And like, but it's clear, Miami can't score. There's just a cap, unless Milwaukee is going to just not do what they're supposed to do offensively. I thought a couple things were interesting. It looks like Milwaukee said, hey, Kevin Love, we would like for you not to play as much. I think he's held up in pick and roll, but there's a couple times I was like, oh, they're trying to make him move and yep. And turn that at the level into something that Miami can't deal with. I thought Milwaukee, I don't know if I want to talk about Bobby Portis on Gabe Vincent, because I don't know if that's going to last.
If you don't, I will.
Because Giannis is going to come back eventually, so I just don't think it's going to be a thing. I just think conceptually, it's kind of funny, but it, for me, it lends to, okay, Miami, you need someone to take this space, take this shot, and shoot it. Watching that game, I was like, okay, I get starting Duncan Robinson. Is he going to look at the rim?
No.
Because if he's not going to look at the rim, then okay. Max Strus in pick and roll. He's got to make those shots. Gabe Vincent. The fact that they put Bobby Portis on him as a screen navigator said, hey, bud, you're going to have to make these shots.
That's if I can jump in very briefly. That's what got me. Because, like, I start that game and I see Bobby Portis on Gabe. I was like, oh, okay, so they're just basically doing the copy-paste thing from 2K when you set up your custom adjustments and stuff. Like, oh, okay, so they're just going to keep the four on Gabe Vincent so you can turn those pick and rolls with Bam to a switch. Okay, fine. When they had that man navigating the screen, though, I was like, wait a minute. Why?
They stuck with it. You have to make this pull-up. They need to, if I'm Miami, I am searching Kyle Lowry and Victor Oladipo, all of their belongings, to find that mid-range pull-up and hand it to one of them, because you need someone to be able to hit that shot to get the automatic and it'll be good. I was fine with what Bam did offensively.
Same.
I think Jimmy Butler has been very, very comfortable in this series against Brook Lopez. Now, the interesting part, I know you go Giannis, Jimmy versus Drew is extremely fun. And Drew Holiday is working his tail off to defend that penetration, slide under. Miami tried to go matchup hunting, use Jimmy as a screener. And Drew was like, nope, I'm going to show. Joe Ingles was like, nope, I'm going to show. We're not going to give you that switch. And it's like, ah, well, if Miami's offense isn't there, if they're doing drop to late switch to take away Bam's short roll and Kevin Love's pops, it gets tricky.
Yeah, it's just... I'm glad you hit on the Bam front, because like whatever he found in, let's just say, the second half of game one, like that carried over into game one. Miami opens this game with Max Strus, Duncan Robinson standing beside each other in the left wing, Jimmy Butler screening for Bam at the baseline and getting him a mid-range jumper. He missed it, but I was like, okay, they're trying to establish him early. And even throughout the game, and particularly the third quarter, like game got out of hand, so it didn't really matter to the end result. But like the play, Bam just attacks from the perimeter and just dunks on Brook Lopez. We're like, oh. Well, I'm glad he's being aggressive. He's taking the space like that. I think that portends well moving forward. If he just keeps that mindset, maybe not dunk on Brook all the time. Brook's incredible. But just, I have space. I am going to cycle through this option very quickly. If the handoff's there, cool. If this guy has an advantage, I can pitch to him. We can flow into a pick and roll. Cool. If not, I am attacking now. If he has that there, like that's what Miami needs from him. And the shots will fall or they won't. But process-wise, that's going to be fine. The guard play for Miami is obviously going to be very important. Gabe Vincent pull-ups are going to be very important, as is Kyle Lowry. It was nice to see Victor Oladipo knock down some pull-ups. I don't know if Milwaukee particularly cares about them. The Jimmy Butler comfort point is an interesting one, because he is just kind of seeing the drop, like, all right, well, I'll just flow into these pull-ups, and he's knocking them down. I do wonder, and you know me well, if Giannis is back for game three or game four, whichever one it is, does Milwaukee press that button? But hey, you deal with Giannis, even if you have him navigating, which I think you just go under, but whatever. Even if you have him navigating, you have fun with Brook Lopez stepping up in your face and Giannis coming with the rear view contest. Let's see how comfortable you are there. Or if they're trying to empty the corner like they have been doing so more frequently to close the year, if they empty in the corner with Jimmy Bam pick and rolls. All right, cool. I'll duck under or I'll fight over. This turns into a late switch. Have fun. Both of you have fun. So that's something that I'm keeping an eye on. But beyond that, nice to see better process from Milwaukee. The shooting was insane. Miami cannot defend at that level if they hope to keep these games close, much less win them. And with that, we can now move to the Nuggets and the Timberwolves. Nuggets now with a 2-0 series lead right now, a 122-113 victory in a game two, one that got a little dicey. It looked like we were reaching blowout city in the first half. Minnesota closes it in to, I think, 15. At the end of the first half, and in the third quarter, they just opened the floodgates offensively. I'll start with the question. Do you feel like the Wolves found anything that can carry over moving forward in this series offensively in that third quarter?
They absolutely did. Here's the thing. Denver had been able to play multiple coverages defensively in pick and roll. They had been able to get Jokic to the level, but he also had been able to drop. They were able to mix things in. Throw some switching in depending on the lineup, and you can kind of keep Minnesota in place. In that third quarter, Denver decided, let's put Jokic at the level. And all of the things that Denver doesn't do well, or what when it goes bad, Denver looks bad, happened. Again, everyone wants to point to Jokic defensively. I totally get it. It is about the rotations, the help, and the closeouts. And Minnesota was able to get roles, which, by the way, Minnesota is a team that struggles with switches, can struggle with offense, and you are handing them roles. Why? Anyways, now they're out there driving, kicking, playing automatics. Gobert's getting rolls. You're tweeting about short rolls. Anthony Edwards is driving. They're getting to drive and kick. So they have a path offensively. If we can get to Jokic, if we can get dribble penetration, if they can't keep the ball in front, if their help is off, we can score the basketball. And then if they score, their defense tends to lift up, at least activity-wise. So yeah, I totally, totally get that. You want to break our news that we just found out?
Yes, I guess we can. Just to bounce back to the Suns-Clippers game, apparently. Quality producing happening right now as we record. Kawhi Leonard has been ruled out tonight with a right knee sprain. That seems unfortunate for the Los Angeles Clippers.
All right, so
wow. That just stinks, man. Kawhi's been hooping.
Yeah, unfortunate, no fun. I'm bummed out.
More Russ. Okay.
We'll see. Watch it. Watch the Clippers go zone with like 19 different lineups. It'll be fun. Yeah, I think that being able to get to Jokic, who, by the way, the one defensive point I want to make with Nikola Jokic is he went from like being a tall person that was in the way to this thing where he just kind of stands there almost taking a charge. And it's like, wait, what happened?
Just kind of waves at the guy as it goes by. I don't like that.
That one's got to go. Do you think they found enough?
My honest answer is I don't know. And I say that because I don't know how much of it was super different, because we kind of knew what the formula was with them. If they can get Denver in rotation, they can find good shots. And so that's where my mind went to, hey, did they find anything specific here that's going to carry over, or is this just going to be an execution deal?
That's fair.
And it feels more execution deal to me. I will say, and I think this is something that you pointed out in your game thread as well, Minnesota going to more like double drag actions and then kind of flowing out of some different counters out of that, just to mess with the matchups from Denver's side, I think is interesting. That's something that can lean into more. And also just to flip it, we can talk about Minnesota's defense if you like. Denver just carved them up whenever they emptied out a corner. And it was Jamal Murray, Jokic's two game. It was Nikola Jokic and Aaron Gordon screening for each other. It was swinging it to the other side. MPJ getting some good stuff. It's Bruce Brown coming out, turning the corner. It was just like, man, anytime they open the corner, it's like, all right, Rudy, you got to deal with this. Or Kat, you got to deal with this. Minnesota did not have a good time. And I wonder what their counter to that is going to be moving forward in this series. Because if I'm Denver, I'm starting to spam it.
Here's the thing, right?
Okay.
The problem is you have Kat in a drop for the majority of the series. Not his best coverage, which has hurt him in dribble handoffs and pick and roll all over the place. You had Rudy roaming, but eventually in the second half, you said, no, Rudy, you go guard Nikola Jokic. But then that puts him in empty corner pick and roll, which comes either a drop or a late switch. So I don't know what the right answer is. And side note, Denver running Jokic-Gordon pick and roll when Minnesota had both their bigs on them, which is rude.
That's nasty.
It was just incredibly rude. You got Rudy Gobert trying to navigate a screen. You got Kat kind of switching, kind of trying to figure out if he's supposed to be up there. And Aaron Gordon just,
rim up there. I'll take the dunk, yeah. AG up there somewhere.
So, no, I think that's something they can lean on. Now, the tricky part for Denver is, part of the comeback was Minnesota's activity defensively and scoring. The other part was they just stopped moving the ball for a nice bit. So I wonder how much they want to balance that. But I think if we're talking fourth quarter close game, it's going to be tricky.
Got you. And I would just say I personally buried the lead here. Jamal Murray just went 40 in this game. One, tremendous. Really had the juice off the bounce. I really enjoyed the way that Denver used him. Again, two-man action with Jokic, either with handoffs or pick and rolls. Using him as a screener really had Minnesota thrown for a loop. Just watching, hey, can we afford to switch this? Are we showing here? You got two to the ball there. Just using him as an off-ball screener. It's sometimes just setting up something for him to pop up above the break and then set up a pick and roll from there. Other times, just a cross screen for Jokic and volleying them there. Minnesota didn't really have an answer there. And I was intrigued with the lineup change. Nikhil Alexander-Walker came off the bench in this when they started Torian Prince. I was like, okay, more length on Jamal Murray. That's interesting. He's made that man navigate a bunch of screens. And it's like, well, he's trying. It's not an effort deal. Torian didn't have much fun. And then Nikhil Alexander walked in, and he didn't have much fun either. And then that also came with the other end where it's like, okay, you can knock down shots. We don't really care, though, so we're going to show this help here in the paint when you're spaced on the weak side. If you beat us with shots or with closeout attacks, that's cool. He didn't do enough of that. So I still have some lineup slash combination questions for me in my head with Minnesota, in addition to just what do they do to defend this team? Bigger question that I have, and I guess we can close with Atlanta-Boston. The cat usage offensively. Quiet game for him offensively in this one. Aaron Gordon on cat has just turned a lot of those ball screens into switches. And some of the off-ball stuff, like Denver was switching Jokic sometimes in that game as well. I was like, okay, all of this can't be a switch against cat.
What you mean?
If the entire boat turns into cat, can you dribble 25 feet from the basket to the rim? Or, hey, can you post up this little man and actually get good positioning and then broaden out? Can Minnesota space well enough beyond that to actually open up some opportunities for cat? Like, where do you go if you're Minnesota with cat? Like, how do you open him up?
I've been talking to y'all about this all year. No one wanted to listen to me. This is the trickiest part of this cat and Rudy Gobert pairing. How much is cat going to be on the perimeter? Can you use him as a screener? And what's it look like when he's spaced? It's hard to have Rudy on the floor and not screening, because what's he going to do? It's hard to have Kat out just standing on the perimeter. What's that look like? The issue is, and they need to figure this out quickly before the league spreads the word, teams are extremely comfortable switching a whole lot of folks on Karl-Anthony Towns. If you don't believe me, I saw them do it with Jamal Murray last night. He can't let that be the thing. It can't be switch everybody. Because if Rudy's a switch and Kat's a switch, what do y'all have in the fourth other than Anthony Edwards?
Anthony Edwards, 41 points.
Mike Conley. Big game, big shot making game. So it's just like, I would like to see what are they running for him? What can they do besides here's an elbow touch, here's a post touch? Is he coming off screens? Now, the secondary issue in this particular series, and it's ironic, Kat's minutes at the five are against a Denver lineup with Jeff Green and Aaron Gordon. So, hey, pal, that same issue
is here too, bud.
Come on down. Here's Bruce Brown poking the ball away and then switching and keeping you in front. So it's just, I would like to see him a focused effort to get him the ball, him work to get in his spots, be patient, put pressure on him. It's just, I get the three-point shooting, but it can't be three-pointer bust, and it can't be, you know, fullback dive.
Not fullback, the HB counter. Yeah, the cat touches are just odd. And, like, the post-ups, like, this is where I'm like, this is him. A lot of this is just him when it comes to the post-touches in particular. You can't be getting bumped out the way that you are. I understand the general fear of, weak foul calls, and he is very important to this Timberwolves team. Breaking news, elite analysis there. Very important. You don't want him to pick up his second foul with 6 minutes left in the first, because he's trying to wield off a smaller man that, to your point, they've switched on to Cat. But, like, man, I don't like these 19-foot catches from him. He has to work a little bit hard to establish deeper position. If for no other reason, to at least make Denver think about, do we want to send extra help? And maybe that opens up some cuts. Maybe that opens up some of these hook passes to the dunk spot to Rudy for an easy one or free throw attempts. You're letting Denver off the hook with some of this. And again, I understand I don't want to get a BS foul called on me, because I'm stronger than this dude. And if he leans back hard enough, the ref don't call it. I wish the refs would just let big men battle a little bit more with those kind of situations. Anyway, that's a whole different rant. They need Cat to establish himself a little bit better. Like, this isn't just a this series thing. This is a big picture cat point. Because to your point, if teams just feel like, all right, we can just switch, that's fine. And, you know, we can switch this point guard on him. He'll catch the ball 20 feet from the basket. We can send help. We can send a double. We can play out of that. That's fine. That can't happen.
So you went with he's him derogatory.
Oh. with these post-ups, that's what it's looking like. Very quickly, Atlanta, Boston. Boston with yet another double-digit victory in this one. 2-0 series lead. I am concerned about, honestly, just we said it up top, like this is just a bad matchup for Atlanta, for what they want to open up and just what Boston can do defensively. They really don't have a place to hide Trae Young. And like, we knew that coming into the series, but like, these two games have really highlighted this. Like, Derek White was very good game one. They used him as a screener. He got busy in pick and roll sometimes, had some drives, had some cuts, had some slips when he was used as a screener. Cool. Game two, Atlanta's like, all right, we're going to put Trae Young on Marcus Smart. And then Marcus Smart ran pick and roll. Marcus Smart set screens, which Boston somehow generated over 2 points per possession on the trips featuring a Marcus Smart screen. Let you know how that went. And it's the same off-ball stuff. And I just, like, man, I don't even know how much of it is effort with Trae. Like, there were some effort stuff and some of the off-ball awareness just hasn't been good through two games. But he just poses such an issue for this Atlanta team defensively. And I don't know how they counter that, plus the John Collins thing, plus when the bench comes in, some of the weaker defenders they have there. It's just really tough going right now for Atlanta, I think, is where I ultimately land.
It's tough. It's must-win territory. I don't mean to sound so cliche, but I think they're going to play better in Atlanta. And I think they have a path to victory. They're going to have to make a whole lot of shots. And the defense is going to have to be a little bit better. Boston's going to have to cooperate. The issue is they have to do it twice to really make this a series again. Because right now, Boston is presenting a tough, tough bout of recipes. I think about the fact that they're like, hey, we're going to double-team Jason Tatum. Boston was like, cool, swing three. Very early. Like, the first quarter, Atlanta shot-making. DeAndre Hunter going to work. In the first quarter, Atlanta's losing. Sam Howell's like comfortable. Like,
yeah, that's not ideal.
Yeah, like just long term, they it's gonna take the shot making. They're gonna have to get some stops, get some easy ones. I think you're gonna hear a loud Atlanta crowd for at least one of these games, but I don't know if it solves the overall issues that Boston can throw at them.
Yeah, it's just kind of tough. Like, to your point, like, Boston cooperated for all of like 7 minutes in the first quarter, where you got what you needed from Atlanta, and Boston was doing the quick shot thing, some weird turnovers. It's like, oh, well, this is what we're going to get. This may be to tie it up, head to Atlanta. Maybe they can talk themselves into it a little bit. But it just didn't matter after the end of the first. And, like, hat tip to DeJounte Murray, who balled out, and the drives hit and the pull-ups hit. And, again, kind of general theme and going back to game one, how affected was Boston by it? He scored often, scored efficiently, and it's like, I don't know how much that broke what Boston wanted to do scheme-wise. It would help if, and Trae just has to be more efficient than what he's been offensively. Like, it was better in game two than game one. Through two games, a possession featuring a Trae Young drive is generating 0.61 points per possession, which is 46th among 47 players with at least 10 drives in the postseason. Only player lower than him is Eric Gordon. And Eric Gordon has driven the ball exactly 10 times. And that was the minimum that I said. That can't be the Trae Young experience. He can't pose these problems defensively. And then also, against drop, the floater isn't going. The pull-up three isn't going to the level that you need it to. And just in general, the downhill juice isn't producing what you want. Getting to the free throw line, getting some Celtics in foul trouble, stuff like that. It just goes right back to, I mean, Boston's a better team. This is a very specific matchup that can bother what Atlanta wants to accomplish. They have tried different things. The pace in general is up. They're getting threes up. They have tried to attack the basket. It's just a really tough matchup. And with that, I would like to say thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter if you have not already. If you'd like to watch us on YouTube, this episode won't be on, but the next one will. Subscribe to JJ Redick's YouTube channel. If you want to watch playoff games with us, we are going live on Watch Playback just about every night. You'll get plenty of analysis. You'll also get some slight antics. We're having fun. The link for that will be in the podcast description. It should be hyperlinked. So if so, just click on that, sign up. It's free. It's easy. No shenanigans. If not, just copy the link into your browser, get signed up. Again, it's free. It's easy. No shenanigans. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Buff Bainwell, huh?